pretty tender and juicy at medium and beyond. A hanger steak has a very coarse texture with a distinct grain running through it. Anywhere beyond medium, and it gets too rubbery to chew. Undercook it, on the other hand, and you get meat that is mushy and slippery. Rare hanger steak is simply not the same as rare tenderloin, ribeye, or strip steak. Use a thermometer and cook it to the sweet spot between 125 degrees and 130 degrees Fahrenheit. This gives it some leeway to rise in temperature as it rests. Very high heat is essential. Hanger steaks are relatively thin, and you want to give them a nice char before they get a chance to start overcooking. On the grill, I'll pile up a full chimney of coals under one side of the grill grate and cook the steaks full blast from start to finish, flipping occasionally. On the stovetop, use a cast iron pan and go for smoking hot high heat. Hanger steaks work well with marinades. Finally, hanger steaks are good candidates for sous vide cooking, as it guarantees that they cook evenly all the way through. Cook them in a 125 degree to 130 degree Fahrenheit water bath, then finish them off with the highest possible heat on a grill or the stovetop. Slicing and serving. Like any meat, hanger steak should be allowed to rest for a few minutes after cooking. Let it rest, then slice against the grain and serve. When properly cooked and sliced, a hanger steak is every bit as tender as a ribeye. Skirt steak. Of all the inexpensive cuts on the cow, skirt is probably the greatest dollar-to-flavor value there is. Riddled with plenty of buttery, beefy fat, with a deep, rich flavor and a tender, juicy texture, it's a tough cut not to like. Indeed, I'd say that its flavor is even better than the ribeye and far superior to a relatively bland tenderloin or New York strip. That is, it's a tough cut not to like if you've had it cooked and sliced properly. All too often, you head out to a mid-rate taqueria where the skirt steak, known as asfajitas, little belts in Mexico, sits around in piles on the edges of the griddle, slowly overcooking and turning from tender, juicy, steak fit for a king into your typical tough, leathery, livery-tasting taco stuffing. Equally bad is the uncle who throws it onto a too-cool grill, forgets to rest it, and then slices it improperly, reducing it to inedibly tough rubber bands. Do not be this uncle. Your family may still love you, but they certainly won't like you. Also sold as fajita meat. Where it's cut from. The outside skirt is the diaphragm muscle of the cow. The inside skirt is part of the flank. Shopping. The outside skirt is the traditional cut for fajitas, but it is generally sold only to restaurants. You'd be hard-pressed to find it retail. It comes with a tough membrane attached to it, which needs to be trimmed before it can be cooked. Inside skirt is part of the flank, and it is the more widely available form of skirt steak. It generally comes with the membrane removed, making trimming an easy job at home. All you've got to do is remove some of the excess fat from the exterior, and you're good to go. Trimming. Use a sharp knife and try to take off the fat without digging into the meat. Some fat will remain inside the steak. This is good. It'll render as the meat grills, basting it as it cooks, giving the steak that much more richness and adding to its intense, beefy, buttery flavor. Cooking. There's a single rule when it comes to cooking skirt steak: intense, unrelenting high heat. Forget starting low and slow or cooking sous vide. Skirt steak should be cooked over the highest possible heat from start to finish. And here's why. With a normal thick steak, if you were to cook it over intense heat the entire time, you'd end up with meat that burnt to a crisp on the outside before the center reached the appropriate medium rare. Skirt steak has the opposite problem. It's so thin that unless you cook it over maximum heat, it'll be overcooked before you get any chance to develop a good sear on the exterior. I like to light up an entire chimney of coals, pile them all under one side of the grill, and then add a few more coals on top just for good measure. As soon as those coals on top are hot, throw the suckers on and cook them with a single flip. If you have hardwood coals, now's the time to break them out. They burn faster and hotter than briquettes, making them the ideal choice for grilling skirt steak. Like hanger and other loose-textured cuts, skirt takes well to rubs and marinades. At the very least, use plenty of salt and pepper. Slicing and serving. Take a look at the way the grain flows. Slice the steak with the grain to divide it into 3 to 4 inch long segments. Then rotate each one of those 90 degrees and slice into thin strips. Flank steak. It's hard to think of a cut of meat that is more conducive to cooking for a crowd than flank steak. It's got a robust, beefy flavor and a pleasantly tender texture with a bit of good chew. It comes in large, regular shapes that make cooking, slicing, and serving easy, and the steaks are thin enough that they'll cook through in a matter of minutes, but thick enough that you can still get a nice medium-rare center. Flank steaks are pretty versatile as far as cooking method goes, though they can be a bit unwieldy indoors because of their size. The best way by far is on the grill. With their large surface area, the steaks are made for picking up nice char and smoky flavors, and the types of dishes they can be transformed into, such as fajitas or steak salads, are perfect for al fresco dining. Also sold as stir-fry beef. It's usually sliced in this instance. Where it's cut from? The flank, which is on the steer's belly toward the rear end. Shopping. Once an inexpensive cut and a great alternative to premium steaks, flank steak can run nearly as much as a strip steak these days. When shopping for it, look for an even deep red color with a fair amount of fine fat running along the length of the muscle. Poorly butchered flank steak will either have a thin membrane still attached to parts of it or have had that membrane removed so aggressively that the surface of the meat has been shredded. Look for smooth textured pieces without nicks or gouges. A standard whole flank steak can weigh anywhere between 2 and 4 pounds. Plan on cooking a pound of flank steak for every 3 diners, or a pound and a half if your friends are as hungry as mine usually are. Trimming. Flank steak is so popular that most butchers sell it trimmed and ready to cook. Cooking. Flank has a close-grained texture that makes it suitable for serving anywhere between rare and medium. It can be tough to fit into a skillet without cutting it into smaller pieces, but it's great on the grill. Cook as you would a hanger steak. High heat, flipping it occasionally, until it develops a good crust on both sides. If it begins to burn before the center reaches the desired temperature, transfer it to the cooler side of the grill to finish more gently. Flank steak doesn't sop up marinades quite as readily as the more loose-textured hanger or skirt steak, but it's still worth marinating it for an added flavor boost. Slicing and serving. Use a long, thin, sharp carving knife or chef's knife to slice the steak against the grain. Holding the knife at a shallow angle will get you pieces that are a bit wider, which makes for a better presentation. Short ribs. The Koreans and the Argentinians know something that we don't. Short rib is the best cut of meat for grilling. In Korean restaurants, it's on the menu as galbi. At most of them, you'll find the short ribs cut flanken style, that is, thin slices cut across the ribs so you see a few rib bone cross sections in each slice. At fancier restaurants, you'll find the ribs served as a single bone each, the meat carefully butterflied so that it stretches out into a long thin strip. In Argentina, the cut is known as asado de tira, and it's served thick cut, grilled on an open fire, and drizzled with herb oil and vinegar-based chimichurri sauce. More intensely beefy than a strip steak, more well-marbled than a ribeye, far more flavorful than a tenderloin, and thicker and meatier than a skirt or hanger steak, there's nothing, and I mean nothing, better on the grill than short ribs. Also sold as galbi, Korean, Jacob's Ladder, UK, when cut across the bones, asado de tira, Argentina. Where it's cut from? The ribs, duh. Although short ribs can be cut numerous ways, they generally come from the area of the ribs a bit farther down toward the belly than rib steaks or strip steaks, which come from closer to the back. When cut into long slabs with bones about 6 to 8 inches in length, short ribs are referred to as English cut. When sliced across the bones so that each slice has 4 to 5 short sections of bone, they are known as flanken style. Shopping. Like any meat, short ribs can vary in quality. The very best come from high up on the ribs, close to where ribeye steaks are cut from. The top 6 inches or so is what you're looking for. With ribs cut from this region, You'll find a bone about 6 inches long, 1.5 inches wide, and 1/2 inch thick, with a slab of meat sitting on top of it about 1 inch high. Some less scrupulous butchers will sell sections cut from much lower down on the rib as short ribs. You'll recognize these by the skimpy amount of meat on them. Don't bother with them. They won't work at all, unless you've got a couple of hungry dogs. Look for meaty ribs with plenty of marbling. Either English or Flanken style will work just fine on the grill, but I prefer to buy English-cut ribs. This affords me the possibility to remove the meat from the bone in one relatively thick steak. If you can manage to find boneless short ribs, all the better. Simply slice them into individual steaks, and they're ready to cook. No waste. Trimming. If the ribs have a big cap of fat, trim it to about 1/8 inch. There should be no need to remove any sort of silver skin or connective tissue. English-cut short ribs can be cut off the bone as well. Save the bones for stock or the dogs. Cooking. Because short ribs have such a high fat content, they are unforgivably rich, they're a relatively foolproof cut to work with. The intramuscular fat acts as an insulator, which means that they cook a bit more slowly, giving you a larger window of time to pull them off the grill at the desired level of doneness. I treat my short ribs much as I would a high-end Japanese Wagyu-style steak. That is, whether you like your regular steaks rare or well done, I very strongly suggest cooking your short ribs to medium rare, about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Any cooler than that, and the intramuscular fat will remain solid and waxy, rather than turning unctuous and juicy. Much hotter, and the fat will start running out copiously, making your ribs tough and dry. Short ribs cook best over a moderately hot, not blazing hot fire. Like all things, fat has a tendency to burn when it gets too hot. If you were to cook your ribs over an inferno, that dripping fat would vaporize, leaving a foul-tasting, sooty deposit on the surface of your meat. You want to have the short ribs cooked through to the center exactly when the exterior becomes deep brown and crusty. They can also be cooked like a steak in a hot cast-iron pan. I prefer my short ribs the Argentine way, seasoned with nothing but salt, and served with chimichurri sauce. Slicing and serving. Short ribs are a bit tougher than premium cuts of meat. So, once again, slicing thinly against the grain before serving, or instructing your diners to do so, is the way to go. Tri-tip steak. If you're not from Santa Maria, California, you may not have heard of tri-tip, the large, tender, triangular muscle cut from the bottom sirloin of a steer. If you are from Santa Maria, you can bet your bowl of pinquito beans that you've had more than your share of the cut. It's the primary cut used for Santa Maria-style barbecue, a regional barbecue style that's not well known outside of Central California, and that, by some standards, wouldn't qualify as real barbecue at all. See, Santa Maria-style barbecue is technically a fast-cooking method. That is, the meat is cooked over an open pit, burning with red oak just until medium rare. No low and slow smoking, no breakdown of connective tissue, which actually tri-tip is very low in, no fancy barbecue sauces. Just seasoned beef, grilled, sliced, and served with a bowl of native pinquito beans, a tomato salsa, and buttery garlic bread. Sounds pretty darn good to me. Also sold as Santa Maria steak, Newport steak, when cut into individual steaks, Aguillotte Baron, France, Punta de Anca, Punta de Solomo, or Colita de Quadril, Latin America, Maminha, Brazil. Where it's cut from. The bottom sirloin, from the muscle group that controls the steer's back legs. It is the muscle that applies force to the steer's kneecaps. Shopping. There's not much to watch out for here. Tri-tips are pretty consistent. If you have a choice between prime and choice grades, I'd go with prime. This is a case where you're going to want all the fat you can get, because tri-tip is a generally lean cut that is prone to drying out. Trimming. A tri-tip should need no trimming, but if there is any silver skin on the surface, use a thin, sharp knife to remove it. Cooking. Tri-tip is not huge on beef flavor or fat, so it's a generally good idea to season it generously or serve it with a flavorful sauce. It has a tapered shape that makes it cook unevenly. If you have diners who prefer more well-done meat, give them slices from the thinner, tapered end. Traditional Santa Maria-style barbecue calls for salt, black pepper, and perhaps a bit of garlic rubbed onto the meat before cooking. Personally, I like a somewhat heartier spice rub with paprika, a bit of cumin, cayenne, and some brown sugar. The flavor really helps boost the meat when sliced and served. Just as with cooking a big fat steak, the key to even cooking, juicy meat, and a nice crust is to start the sucker over the cooler side of the grill with a lid on. You can add some soaked wood chunks to the coals, tri-tip takes well to smoke, and cook it to within 5 to 10 degrees of its target pull temperature, which is 5 degrees lower than its target final temperature. For medium rare, that's about 115 degrees to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. After that, slide it on over to the hot side and cook it until nicely charred all around. Slicing and serving. Pull it off, let it rest for about 10 minutes. It is, after all, a big cut of meat, and then thinly slice against the grain with a sharp knife. You can serve it with whatever kind of sauce you like. The traditionalist in me says to go with a tomato and celery-studded Santa Maria-style salsa. The who-cares-as-long-as-it-tastes-good person in me often tells the traditionalist to shut the hell up and serve it with any of the sauces in this chapter. Flap meat. I first knew flap meat by its local New England name of sirloin tips. Go to any old-school dive or tavern with a menu, and you're bound to run into them, cut into cubes, stuck on a skewer, and grilled over an open coal fire, just like they do at Santarpio's in East Boston. When grilled right, flap meat is tender and juicy, and has a robust beefy flavor that a lot of other cuts for kebabs lack. That, and it's cheap. Not just cheaper than tenderloin, but still kinda expensive cheap, but actually cheap. It wasn't until I moved back to New York City that I realized that nobody outside New England knows what sirloin tip is. And it wasn't until even later that I realized that the faux hanger and flap meat that butchers around here sell are in fact the exact same cut of beef, just left whole rather than sliced into tips. Of all the inexpensive cuts of beef, flap meat is one of the most versatile. It takes great to fast cooking methods like grilling or searing. It's excellent cooked whole and then sliced into thin strips. It can't be beat, cubed, and put on skewers. It has a coarse texture that grabs onto marinades and seasonings. It's even great as a slow-cooked braise, where it falls apart into tender shreds, like a Cuban ropa vieja. Also sold as faux hanger, bavette, France, sirloin tip, New England. Where it's cut from? The bottom sirloin butt, the same general region that tri-tip comes from. Shopping. Flap meat comes in several forms, depending on where you live, but it's pretty much always delivered to the supermarket or butcher as a whole cut of meat. So if you live in an area where selling it in strips or cubes is the norm, such as New England, instead ask the butcher to sell you a whole trimmed flap. This gives you more options when you get it home. As it is a relatively lean cut, there's not really any need to spring for prime-grade flap. The choice stuff will taste just as good and costs less. Trimming. Flap meat generally requires very little trimming. Remove any silver skin. Cooking. More so than any other cut I know of, flap meat is pretty terrible when it's cooked rare. You can see for yourself when it's still raw. This is some mushy-ass meat. Only by cooking it to medium rare or medium can you get it firm enough to not squish it around in your mouth as you chew it. Flap meat works particularly well on the grill. It doesn't require the extreme heat of skirt steak, and it doesn't have the fat flare-up problems of short ribs, which makes it pretty simple to cook. Just build a hot fire on one side of the grill, lay on the flap, after seasoning it, of course, and flip every minute or so until it gets to at least 125 degrees Fahrenheit at its thickest part. Slicing and serving. Flap meat has an extremely coarse grain with an obvious direction. It runs crosswise all the way down the steak. This makes it hard to cut against the grain into thin, bite-sized pieces. You'd end up with strips sliced lengthwise. Instead, the best thing to do is first divide it into three or four pieces, slicing with the grain, then to rotate each of those pieces 90 degrees and thinly slice them against the grain. Since its shape, thickness, and proclivity for marinades makes flap similar to flank steak. You can use them pretty much interchangeably. Think of it as flank steak's tastier, sexier cousin. Going against the grain. As you know, meat is made up of bundles of long muscle fibers that are laid out parallel to one another. Take a close look at your meat, and you'll see that, just like wood, it's got a grain. In some muscles, like the loin, where strip and ribeye steaks come from, or tenderloin, aka fillet, that grain is very fine. The muscle fiber bundles are thin enough that they don't form a significant grain. Cuts from weak muscles like these will be soft and tender no matter how you slice them. Inexpensive cuts, like skirt steak, hanger steak, or flank, have thicker muscle fiber bundles with a clearly defined grain. These fibers are tough cookies. They have to be. Their job is to move the moving parts of an animal that is much, much bigger than you. Try to tear a single muscle fiber by stretching it along its length, and you'll have a pretty hard time. But pulling individual muscle fibers apart from one another is relatively easy. So, before putting a piece of flank, hanger, or skirt steak in your mouth, the goal should be to shorten those muscle fibers as much as possible with the help of a sharp knife. If you cut with your knife parallel to the grain, you end up with long muscle fibers that are tough for your teeth to tear through. Slicing the meat thinly against the grain, however, delivers very short pieces of muscle fiber that are barely held together. Consider the difference between slicing with the grain and slicing against the grain. Really, that's about all you need to know. So you have full permission to skip the rest of this sidebar right now. But for those of you who, like me, had the greatest geometry teacher in the world in 9th grade, and were thus instilled with a preternatural desire to draw triangles and measure stuff, well, in the words of Mr. Sturm, get your gas masks, because we are climbing Mount Elegance, and the air up there is quite thin. Quantitatively, how much of an effect does the way you slice a steak actually have? Let's set up some definitions. Let W be the distance you move the knife between slices, that is, the width of a slice. Let M be the length of the meat fibers in each slice. Finally, let theta be the angle between the knife blade and the meat fibers. Given a bit of high school trigonometry, you can quickly come up with the following formula. M equals W divided by the sine of theta. So, what are the implications of this? Well, if our goal is to minimize the length of the meat fibers, M, then we need to maximize the sine of theta. When the meat is cut into 0.5-inch strips at a 90-degree angle to the direction of the meat fibers, sine of theta is equal to 1, that is, maximized, and the meat fibers are exactly as long as the slice is wide, that is, 0.5-inch. Cut them at a 45-degree angle instead, and while their width is still 0.5-inch, the length of the meat fibers has reached 0.707-inch. That's the square root of 0.5 for all you nerds out there who get excited over 45 degrees, 45 degrees, 90 degrees right triangles. That's an increase of almost 50%. Now take it to the extreme. If you were to cut perfectly parallel to the meat fibers, then the sine of theta will be equal to 0, and, according to the unbreakable laws of mathematics, your meat fibers would stretch all the way into infinity. That's one big cow. Moral of the story. Cut your meat perpendicular to the grain to maximize tenderness. This applies to all types of meat. Beef, lamb, pork, turkey, buffalo, bison, mammoth, you name it. If it's got muscles, the direction you slice matters. The best fajitas. I'm not particularly proud of my time spent working at the kinds of cheesy chain restaurants you'd find next to the Victoria's Secret at the mall, or perhaps in Times Square. But aside from making me shun any writer that uses the phrase X to perfection, it did teach me one valuable lesson. People love meat served on a sizzling platter. It was a well-known phenomenon. If a waiter sold one order of extreme fajitas, trademark, to a table in their section, a half dozen more orders would quickly follow. The meat itself should be ultra-juicy, with an overwhelming, almost buttery beefiness. This is skirt steak, after all, the butteriest of all beef, accented by a marinade that is slightly sweet, very savory, and packed with lime and chili. While fajitas are traditionally made with outside skirt, part of the diaphragm muscle of the steer, the cut is pretty much unavailable unless you work for a restaurant that special orders it. At the butcher or meat counter, you're far more likely to find inside skirt, which will do us just fine. Pan-seared pork chops. Now that we've perfected pan-searing beef, how hard could pork be? The answer? Not very. Indeed, the only difference between cooking a fat steak and cooking a fat pork chop lies in how to select it and the final temperature. In the old days, that is, before the 1990s, people in this country believed that all pork had to be cooked to at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit in order to rid it of pesky worms that could infect you. These days, our pork is just as safe as our beef, so you can cook it to medium or even medium rare with confidence. I like my pork best when it's a rosy pink, 135 degrees to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. When selecting pork chops, you're likely to find four options at the butcher. They're all cut from the loin of the pig. Name: blade end chop. Description: cut from the front of the loin near the shoulder, it contains several muscle groups, all divided by swaths of fat. This is my favorite cut, because it is self-basting. It's very hard to get a dry blade chop. Name: rib chop. Description: cut from farther back along the loin, this is the picture-perfect chop you'll find at fancy restaurants. It's got a large, smooth eye of meat and is easy to cook evenly. However, that eye of meat is relatively low in fat, making it easy to overcook and relatively dry. Name: center cut chop. Description: the equivalent of a T-bone steak, a center cut pork chop contains part of both the loin and the tenderloin. It's impressive looking, but I find it very hard to cook evenly. The tenderloin cooks faster than the loin, and the bone gets in the way, preventing you from getting good contact with the pan. Name: sirloin chop. Description: cut from near the back end of the loin, this chop contains tons of muscles from the hip and ham. Compared to the other chops, it's tough and not particularly tasty, and I don't buy it very often. Pork has a particular affinity for sweet sauces, so when serving it, I usually like to make a fruit preserve-based pan sauce, or perhaps one flavored with maple syrup, or even apples and cider. Enhanced pork. Unlike beef, which has a ton of internal fat, most pork these days is relatively lean, making it very easy to overcook. One way to fix this problem is by brining it. Just as with turkey and chicken, a soak in a saltwater solution can cause the meat's protein structure to loosen up, allowing it to retain more moisture as it cooks, though, just as with poultry, it'll also dilute the flavor. Pork producers figured this out a while ago, and many of them started injecting their pork with a briny solution. The vast majority of industrially raised pork in this country is now sold in this form, known as enhanced pork. To see if your pork has been enhanced, check the label. If it is, it'll say something like, with up to 10% sodium solution. Seems convenient, right? Pre-brined meat? Unfortunately, the brine solution sits in the meat for far too long. Rather than tasting simply juicy, most enhanced pork borders on spongy, with an odd ham-like texture. I much prefer to buy unenhanced natural pork and dry brine it myself, allowing me to control exactly how much liquid it retains. Oftentimes, I don't brine it at all, knowing that if I cook them carefully and monitor the temperature, the chops will still end up nice and juicy. To dry brine pork chops, season well on all surfaces with kosher salt. Place on a wire rack set in a rimmed baking sheet and refrigerate, uncovered, for at least 45 minutes and up to 3 days. Buckle up! Pork chops have a tendency to buckle as they cook, making it hard to maintain even contact with a pan. This happens when the layer of fat around the chop's exterior shrinks faster than the meat inside, squeezing it and causing it to buckle. To prevent this from happening, score the fat in two or three places with a sharp knife. Your chops won't look as flawless, but they'll cook a heck of a lot more evenly. Pan-seared chicken parts. There's a terrible problem sweeping this country, an insidious one that has managed to work its way into nearly every household, with no distinctions among race, gender, or class. I'm talking about dry chicken breasts, and it's time for us to just say no. Luckily, there's an easy program to help you do it, and all it requires is a small investment, a good instant read thermometer. As with many problems in life, the root causes of dry chicken are noble, and they stem from the government's, more specifically, the Food and Drug Administration's recommendation to cook chicken breasts to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. Just like beef and pork, chicken meat tightens as you cook it, and by the time it's reached 165 degrees Fahrenheit, it's irrevocably dry. With chicken legs, this is not so much of a problem. Because of their large amounts of fat and connective tissue, you can cook a chicken leg all the way to 180 degrees Fahrenheit or even 190 degrees Fahrenheit and still get some semblance of succulence. Chicken breasts, though, with their large, roundish shape and total lack of fat, can't handle temperatures much above 145 degrees Fahrenheit. So, what's the best way to cook a chicken? If we learned anything from pan-searing steaks and pork chops, it would seem to be to flip the chicken repeatedly as it cooks. Well, I tried it and quickly learned that a chicken is not a cow, and there are key differences between the structure of a chicken breast and that of a steak that make flip cooking unfeasible, namely the skin. Luckily for us, the skin provides some amazing benefits that allow us to cook chicken much more easily than we can cook beef and pork. Now, I know some odd folks don't like eating chicken skin, surely its most delicious feature, but I'm here to tell you that regardless of whether you end up eating it or pushing it to the side of your plate, it should stay on the chicken while you cook it. Here's the thing. Without skin, what happens when you try to pan-sear a chicken breast? The meat at the exterior dries out, turning stringy and leathery, and not at all pleasant. Try using the multiple flip method with a boneless, skinless chicken breast, and you'll end up leaving half the chicken on the bottom of the pan as you flip it. There are few things in life I hate more than skinless, boneless chicken breasts. Rule numero uno for great chicken is to start by buying skin-on, bone-in chicken. Leaving the skin on the chicken not only prevents the breast meat from overcooking at the surface, it also allows you to let the chicken cook for a longer time on one side without the danger of uneven cooking you'd get with steaks or chops. It's because chicken skin, with its abundance of fat, is a natural insulator. Think about it. Fat, through millions of years of evolution, has been designed to help regulate temperature. Its purpose is to even out abrupt changes in temperature so that animals can move relatively freely between cold and hot environments without dying of shock. Perhaps it was never intended to see a situation as extreme as the refrigerator to the skillet, but it performs its role admirably nevertheless. With a layer of skin on one side and an insulating bone on the other, it becomes exponentially easier to cook chicken evenly. All you've got to do is cook it skin side down first in a hot skillet. Don't try and move it until it releases itself freely. Then flip it over and toss it into a moderately hot oven to finish. So long as you're careful about monitoring its temperature and allow it to rest, never again will you have to deal with anything other than moist, juicy, tender meat. And, just like with pork chops, brining your chicken before cooking can help it to become even juicier, though it's a largely unnecessary step, provided you're careful with your thermometer, and it has the same drawback as when brining pork. The chicken flavor gets diluted with water. I see it more as a safeguard against overcooking. Quick chicken cutlets. There are times in life, say 15 minutes before that Mr. Wizard marathon is about to start, when even simple pan-roasted chicken parts take too long to cook. At these moments, wise home cooks call on that great savior of the quick dinner, chicken cutlets. Made by splitting a boneless chicken breast horizontally in half and gently pounding the resulting pieces to a thickness of about a quarter inch, they cook in less time than it takes to boil an egg. Once you've prepped the chicken, you've got all of 3 minutes before it's ready to eat, 10 minutes if you want to add a pan sauce. I would. Most supermarkets carry cutlets, but you can make your own starting with whole boneless, skinless chicken breasts. Because of the cutlet's thinness, You've got to use very high heat when cooking them, lest they overcook before they have a chance to brown and build up flavor. I like to dredge my cutlets in a little bit of flour before adding them to the skillet. The thin coat of flour browns more efficiently than plain chicken does, giving you color more quickly while offering some amount of protection to the meat. My initial thought when cooking chicken cutlets was that both sides should be cooked for about the same amount of time. After all, I wanted even browning, right? But after trying this method over and over, I found that it simply wasn't possible to brown both sides without really overcooking the meat. So, why not just brown one side extra well? It worked like a charm. I placed the cutlets in a skillet with hot oil and cooked them without moving until the first side was well browned. At this stage, the cutlets were already almost cooked through. All they needed was a quick kiss of the flame on the second side, about 30 seconds worth, and they were finished, ready to rest and serve. Salmon that doesn't stink. I hate salmon with a passion. Chalky, dry, smelly, slimy-skinned, the worst of the worst when it comes to fish. At least, that's what I would have said about a decade ago when the only salmon I had tasted was the overpoached stuff at buffets or overcooked specimens at restaurants that, frankly, didn't know what they were doing. I don't know if I was running in the right circles, but it seemed de rigueur in my youth for everyone to cook salmon to a shade just past well done. We didn't exit these culinary dark ages until sometime in the 1990s, by which time my bias against the fish had been firmly established. It wasn't until I started cooking in nice restaurants, the kind that I could never afford to go to as a civilian, that I realized that it wasn't the salmon that was at fault, but rather the cook. Properly cooked salmon is amazing, whether it's got crisp, crackly skin that can rival the best roast chickens, or tender, moist, flavorful meat that melts on your tongue like butter, or sometimes both. There's a reason, after all, why salmon is the most popular fresh fish in this country, and why it's the fish I've chosen to work mainly with here. That said, the techniques I'm going to discuss apply to any thick, robust fish fillets, such as halibut, red snapper, or sea bass. Pan-searing salmon. There's an unholy trinity of fates that can befall salmon. If you've ever cooked salmon, these are probably all too familiar sights. The picked scab. Flaky bits of salmon flesh that get stuck to the pan as it cooks. Not only does it make the cooked fillet look like a pockmarked teenage crater face, it also makes the pan a bitch and a half to clean when you're done. The leatherhead. There may be something soft and tender underneath, but the dried-out, stringy, crusty, downright malicious exterior is all you can pay attention to. The bloomin' bumin. That's right, the white gunk that gets squeezed out of the layers of salmon flesh, oozy and unattractive like a popped pimple. What's up with the blemish similes today? It's not just that it's something you don't want to eat, it's also a pretty surefire indication that the salmon has been overcooked beyond repair. Luckily, the first two problems can be solved relatively easily. A closer look. How many of you have been intimate with a salmon fillet? Raise your hands. I thought so. Well, it's time you made the leap. When was the last time you looked closely at the cross-section of a salmon fillet? I mean, really closely. Well, here's what you'd see. Starting from the top, we've got pale orange, red flesh. This is the bulk of the matter, and if you get your salmon fillets skinless, then it's basically all you're left with. Depending on the species of salmon, the color can vary from a deep dark red to a paler orange pink. We'll talk more in a moment about salmon flesh's cooking characteristics. Right above the meat, you'll find a layer of subcutaneous fat. Depending on the species, the time of year, the availability of food, and a number of other factors, the thickness of the fat layer may vary, but all salmon have it. It serves both as an energy store for the fish and as a means of insulating its body from wide temperature changes between the ocean waters and the river it swims to during the spawning season. Skin. Some fish have thick, leathery skin. Salmon skin is some of the nicest around, very similar in thickness and texture to chicken skin, making it ideal for cooking. It's these second two layers the subcutaneous fat, and the skin that are of interest to us here. We know that the role of that fat is to insulate the salmon against rapid temperature changes. So why not harness that feature in our cooking method? Just like all meats, the texture of salmon flesh changes as a direct result of the temperature it is raised to. At 110 degrees Fahrenheit and below, the flesh is essentially raw. Translucent and deep orange or red, it has the soft, fleshy texture of good sashimi. At 110 degrees to 125 degrees Fahrenheit, the salmon is medium rare. The connective tissue between layers of flesh has begun to weaken, and if you insert a cake tester or toothpick into the fillet, it should slide in and out with no resistance. The meat is relatively opaque, but still juicy and moist, without any chalkiness or fibrousness. At 125 degrees to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, we are beginning to enter medium to well-done territory. Flakiness will increase, and a chalky texture will start to develop, though it won't be extreme. Albumin will start to get expelled from between the contracting muscle fibers and will begin to coagulate in unattractive white clumps on the exterior of the salmon. In the early stages of this clumping, your salmon is still rescuable if you stop cooking it immediately. At 140 degrees Fahrenheit and above, the salmon has reached its limit. From here on out, it's just going to get chalkier, drier, and more unattractive. This is what salmon that sits in the steam table at the cafeteria looks like, and probably why you didn't like salmon as a kid. So, your goal is really to keep as much of the salmon below the 140 degree Fahrenheit temperature range, and preferably closer to the 125 degree Fahrenheit range, as possible. To do this, make sure always cook salmon skin on if you're pan roasting, even if you plan on serving it skinless. By cooking salmon with the skin on, you can alleviate any sort of overcooking problems in the outer layers of flesh. The insulative subcutaneous fat acts as a heat barrier, transmitting heat to the interior flesh very, very slowly. This slow heat transfer means that skin-on salmon cooks much more evenly and gently than skinless salmon. The skin fulfills the exact same role that a batter or breading supplies on a piece of fried chicken or a tempura shrimp, a buffer to slow down heat transfer and provide a crisp element while keeping the flesh underneath from overcooking. You may ask, but what about the other side of the fillet? A salmon fillet only has skin on one side, right? And right you are. We still have the potential problem of overcooking the skinless side. The solution? Just cook it through almost entirely with the skin side down. French chefs who want to sound lofty like to call this unilateral cooking, cooking from one side only. Personally, I cheat just a bit, flipping the salmon over for the last 15 seconds or so, just to firm up the second side. But cooking salmon skin on does lead to a few other possible problems that need to be dealt with. The woes of skin-on fillets. First off, if you aren't careful, you still get the leaking albumin problem with skin-on salmon fillets. At its worst, the skin gets solidly fused to the skillet, and the meat ends up completely separating from the skin as it cooks. This is not a terrible thing if you don't plan on eating the skin, and indeed, if you want to serve a skinless fillet, it's the best way to do it. Cook the fillet skin on, then slide a thin spatula in between the skin and the flesh to separate them. It's not the end of the world. What's left of the skin is still relatively crisp, and the flesh underneath may be perfectly cooked, but it's certainly not the kind of thing that's going to impress the mother-in-law. After cooking my way through several pounds of salmon fillets at various temperature ranges, I found that the key to getting the skin to stay intact is serendipitously the same method that gets you the most evenly cooked, moistest, tenderest salmon. And guess what? This technique will work for any firm-fleshed, thick fish fillet, such as halibut, bass, grouper, or snapper. I've broken it down into a few easy steps. Perfect fish tip 1. Preheat the oil. Know why that fish likes to stick to the metal pan? It's not just a matter of being, well, sticky. It's actually a chemical bond that occurs between the fish and the pan at a molecular level. This happens with all meat. With land-dwelling animals like beef or pork, though, it's not quite as big a deal. The robust flesh of land animals sticks to itself better than it sticks to a pan. The worst you'll get is a deposit of browned proteins that have been expelled from the meat as it cooks. With tender fish, on the other hand, it's very easy for it to stick to the pan better than it sticks to itself. Rather than lifting cleanly, it tears. The key to preventing this is to make sure that the skin heats up as fast as possible. With enough hot fat in the pan, the skin will have heated up, causing its proteins to tighten and coagulate before it comes into direct contact with the hot metal. This prevents it from forming a strong molecular bond with the metal and makes subsequent flipping easier. Perfect fish tip 2. Drier is better. Nothing cools down oil faster than wet stuff being added to it. Rather than working towards searing your meat, the energy from the hot oil ends up getting used to evaporate excess moisture. The drier your meat before it goes in the pan, the better. I press my fish fillets firmly between paper towels before I transfer them to the pan, skin side down. Perfect fish tip 3. Hold on tight. She's a fighter. Fish skin shrinks as it cooks due to proteins tightening and water and fat being driven off. What happens when this occurs? Like a bimetal strip, the fish fillet will begin to curl up on itself. This curvature can cause uneven cooking. The edges of the skin in tight contact with the pan will end up overcooking and burning, while the central regions that are lifted off the pan will barely cook at all. This is not an ideal state of affairs. To counteract this problem, I use a thin, flexible metal fish spatula to hold the fillets firmly in place as their bottom sides cook. This is of utmost importance during the first minute or two of cooking. After that, the fillet's shape will be set and they will continue to cook evenly. Perfect fish tip 4. Slow and steady. In order to get perfectly crisp skin, three things need to happen simultaneously. Fat needs to render out, water needs to evaporate, and proteins need to set. Cook too hot, and your water will evaporate too fast. The temperature rapidly climbs, and the proteins set and start to burn before the fat has had a chance to render out properly. You'll end up with fish skin that is slightly crisp in spotty patches on the surface, while still gelatinous, greasy, and fatty underneath. Preheating the oil over a relatively high heat to prevent the sticking problems explained in tip 1, then immediately reducing the heat once the fish is added, solves the problem. The result is shatteringly crisp, perfectly rendered, brown, crunchy skin, just like the best pan-seared chicken. And here's another bird to kill with that same stone. Slow and steady cooking also leads to a more evenly cooked finished result. Say goodbye to coagulated albumin. Perfect fish tip 5. Don't flip until it's ready. If there's one more important trick I've learned about pan roasting foods in all my years cooking, it's this one. Never force your food out of the pan. It'll come on its own when it's good and ready. I use that flexible metal fish spatula for all of my flipping, but I find that if after some very gentle prying the fish doesn't release, it's not ready yet. Let it continue cooking, and once the skin is completely rendered and crisp, it should detach from the pan quite easily. Perfect fish tip 6. Break out the thermometer. You knew this one was coming, right? If you've been paying attention, you'll know I'm a huge fan of the Thermapen Instant Read Thermometer. Get yourself one, and you will never, repeat, never overcook your fish again. That is, unless you are like me and stop to take photos while the fish is in the skillet, thereby letting it come all the way up to 137 degrees Fahrenheit when you were aiming for 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Perfect fish tip 7. Just a kiss on the backside. Just a repeat from what I said earlier. Cook your fish almost all the way through, skin side down, as that is the side that's insulated. The other side needs just the briefest kiss from the flame. Follow all these tips, and you should end up with something that has brown, crisp, crackling skin with no greasy, gelatinous fat underneath. A thin layer of ever so slightly flaky meat underneath, followed by a wide expanse of tender, juicy, not the least bit chalky flesh, and a central core with a creamy, buttery texture bordering on sashimi-esque. This is how fish should look and taste. How to buy, store, and prepare fish for cooking. There's a reason that fish is far more prone to spoilage than the flesh of land animals. Spoilage occurs via two means: the breakdown of cells through the action of enzymes naturally present in meat, and the proliferation of bacteria. Both of these things occur at faster rates as the temperature increases. Now, land-based, warm-blooded animals like cows, chickens, and pigs are used to living in warm environments, and they have metabolisms to match. Take their meat and refrigerate it, and enzymatic and bacterial action slows down to a crawl. Fish, on the other hand, are designed to operate in the low temperatures of ocean waters. Some species of Arctic or deep water fish spend most of their lives in water that is just barely above freezing. Compared to that, the 40 degrees Fahrenheit of an average refrigerator is positively balmy. So fish-related enzymatic action will occur just fine in your fridge or the fish market's display case. That's why it's so hard to find great fish on a regular basis, and why you should cook fish as soon as possible after buying it. Buying. Here are some tips for buying fish. Look at the fish market itself. Is everything clean and orderly? Is the fish displayed with care and kept on top of and under ice at all times? If your fishmonger looks careless with his wares, even in front of the customer, chances are you're not getting goods worth paying for. Look at the fish. Does it look fresh? Whole fish should have shiny scales, perfectly clear eyes, and bright red gills. Bloodshot or cloudy eyes are an early sign of spoilage. Fillets and steaks should look shiny, fresh, and moist. Smell the fish. Fresh fish should not have a fishy aroma. It should just smell faintly briny. Any hint of ammonia is a bad sign. Poke the fish. If they'll let you, that is. Fresh fish has resilient flesh that springs back when you gently poke it. If the flesh is mushy or your finger leaves an indentation, leave the fish behind. Storing. As with asparagus or corn, the best way to store fish is not to. You should plan on buying it just before you're going to take it home, put it in the fridge as soon as you get there, and cook it within a few hours. If you must buy your fish the day before or even 2 days before, keep it as cold as possible. With very clean hands, rinse the fish thoroughly under cold running water to wash away any surface bacteria, then carefully pat it dry with paper towels. Transfer the fish to a Ziploc plastic bag, squeeze out as much air as possible, and seal the bag. Place a frozen ice pack in the bottom of a baking dish and place the bag with the fish directly on top of it. Place a second ice pack on top of the fish. You can also use Ziploc bags of ice in place of the ice packs. Store the fish for up to 2 days, replacing the ice packs as they thaw. Boning fillets. More often than not, fish fillets you buy from the supermarket or fish market still have a few bones left in them. To remove them, you'll need a pair of sturdy tweezers. Gently run your fingers back and forth along each fillet until you locate the ends of the bones. They'll feel like firm little bumps in the flesh. Use your fingertip to press the flesh right around the end of the bone to expose it a little bit. Grasp the exposed end of the bone firmly with the tip of the tweezers. Hold your free hand flat against the fish as near the bone side as possible and extract the bone by pulling it in the direction it's pointing to minimize damage to the flesh. Discard the bone and repeat until the fish is clean. Skinning fillets. I like to cook my fish skin on, even if I'm going to serve it skinless, as the skin helps insulate the fish from the heat of the pan or oven, giving you more evenly cooked flesh. But if you'd like to remove the skin from a fish fillet, here's how it's done. Step 1. First incision. Use a sharp chef's knife to cut through the flesh right at the very edge of the fillet, exposing the skin. Step 2. Grab on tight. Grab the exposed skin using a clean kitchen towel or a sturdy paper towel to get a grip. Step 3. Slide the knife in. Slide the knife under the flesh, angling the blade down toward the skin. Slowly take the skin off by very gently moving the knife back and forth as you pull the fish back by the skin. The fish should move more than the knife. Step 4. Finish her off. Keep going, gently moving the knife back and forth in a sawing motion as you pull the skin until it is completely detached from the filet. Trim off any small bits you may have missed. Samplin' salmon. There was a time not long ago when salmon was salmon. It was the pink fish that skinny people ordered at restaurants or fancy ladies in French hats picked on at a high-class buffet. These days, diners are a little more aware of what's out there, or are at least aware that there are options when it comes to salmon. Here's a quick guide to what you might find in the market. King salmon, also known as Chinook, is the largest salmon species and one of the most popular at the fish counter. In the wild, these salmon can grow to over 100 pounds and live for several years, making them prized among game fishermen. Their large, thick fillets make for relatively easy cooking, though they are not the most flavorful species. Farm-raised king salmon tend to be smaller, with a bit more intramuscular fat, giving them more richness. Coho are far smaller than king salmon, with denser, brighter, more flavorful flesh. With relatively little intramuscular fat and a very fine texture, the fish is great for cured preparations such as gravlax. Sockeye salmon get their name from a Halkomelem word from the indigenous people of British Columbia. Nothing to do with either socks or eyes. Known for their deep red flesh and full flavor, they are quite small, which makes them difficult to cook. Their thinner fillets are prone to overcooking. Arctic char are not salmon, but they have a similar reddish-orange flesh colored by the carotenoid pigments they get from feasting on small shellfish. Their flavor and cooking qualities are quite similar to sockeye salmon, though they tend to be a little fattier. In general, I prefer larger, fattier king salmon for high-heat cooking methods like pan roasting, and I find that more flavorful coho and sockeye take well to slower cooking methods like poaching. The thickness and higher fat content of king salmon fillets offer a little more protection from overcooking or drying out, both things that salmon is prone to do in the high heat of a pan or an oven. Beer coolers, plastic bags, and the science of sous vide. There's been a small revolution going on in restaurant kitchens since the early 2000s. It's changed everything from the way line cooks cook and chefs conceive dishes and menus to the way fast food chains maintain consistency and organize their workflow. I'm talking sous vide, from the French for under vacuum, the cooking method wherein food is placed in a vacuum-sealed pouch and cooked in a temperature-controlled water bath. The technique was first introduced to the public in the 1970s at Michel Trois Gros's eponymous restaurant in Rouen, France. But it wasn't until early in this century, when chefs gained access to very precise, laboratory-grade equipment, that it became both practical and possible to implement on a large scale. You may be thinking, okay, interesting, but I'm a home cook, and I couldn't tell a water circulator from a rotary evaporator. What's this got to do with me? You'll just have to trust that I'll get there in a moment. According to famed British chef Heston Blumenthal of the Fat Duck outside London, sous vide cooking is the single greatest advancement in cooking technology in decades. And he's not the only one who thinks so. Everyone from Thomas Keller of New York's Per Se and California's The French Laundry to your local Chipotle Mexican Grill is serving food cooked sous vide. Here's what's great about it. Recall the problem of temperature gradients developing in meat? To recap, food cooks from the outside in, which means that the outer layers are going to be hotter than the very center. Thus, cooked foods develop an internal bullseye pattern, perfectly cooked at the very center and increasingly overcooked as you move out to the edges. So, for example, imagine you're starting with a steak that's a consistent 40 degrees Fahrenheit through and through. Place it in a 500 degree Fahrenheit pan, and the outer layers will almost immediately reach around 212 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature at which the internal moisture at the surface of the steak starts to evaporate. Eventually, all the moisture will dissipate, and the temperature of the outer layers of the steak will continue to increase. It's quite easy for those outer layers to achieve temperatures in excess of 200 degrees Fahrenheit, that's beyond the well-done 160 degrees Fahrenheit stage for steak, before the core temperature has even begun to shift. By the time the center reaches 130 degrees Fahrenheit, medium rare, the outer layers are hopelessly overcooked. Now, imagine cooking the same steak in a constant 130 degrees Fahrenheit environment. Sure, it'll take much longer for the center to get up to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, but it'll get there eventually. And, in the meantime, the outer layers have no chance of overcooking. That's precisely what sous vide cooking is all about. If you place the meat in an airtight, vacuum-sealed pouch and submerge it in a temperature-controlled water bath, the water very efficiently transfers heat energy to the steak while maintaining a very precise temperature. The result is meat that's cooked evenly from edge to edge. And because the water bath is maintained at the final serving temperature of the meat, there's absolutely no way you can overcook it. Need to walk the dog? No problem. Your steak will be waiting. Forget to add the fabric softener? Take your time. The steak will still be there, exactly as you left it. This makes hosting dinner parties extraordinarily easy. Because the Maillard browning reaction doesn't take place at standard sous vide temperatures, most recipes call for searing meat in a hot skillet to add color and flavor after removing it from the bag. In addition, meat naturally contains enzymes called cathepsins that slowly break down tough muscle tissue at first and then work faster and faster as the temperature increases. Giving the meat extra time in the lower temperature range means the cathepsins work overtime, making an already tender steak even more tender. And tender meat is not just about texture. The more loosely packed the muscle fibers, the less they contract during cooking and the fewer juices they expel, making the slow-cooked meat more juicy as well. The advantage for restaurant chefs is obvious. Even at the best restaurants in the world, when using traditional cooking methods, the occasional over- or undercooked protein can be a problem. The seasoned line cooks at Peter Luger's, who've been turning and burning steaks since before vegans existed, still produce the occasional slightly too well-done porterhouse. But with sous vide cooking, even a monkey with a toupee can produce perfectly cooked proteins without fail. Chicken with a juiciness the colonel's wife only dreamed of. Salmon so tender it melts if you look at it too hard. The kind of double-thick pork chops that would have made me break out a celebratory PBR mid-service when I was still a line cook. We're talking perfect food here. Of course, there's a catch, and it's a big one. A typical water circulator will set you back about $1,000. Even the cheaper home versions now on the market, like the Sancerre and the Anova, are at least a couple $100 all in. In fact, there's a whole legion of people out there on the internet who've devoted considerable time and resources into figuring out ways to put together a cheaper sous vide setup. These fall into two categories. Category 1, the rice cooker, aquarium bubbler, PID controller method. It's accurate, but it requires a fair amount of DIY know-how and costs a couple $100 to hack together. Category 2, the David Chang pot of water on the stove, fiddle with the heat as necessary method. This is less accurate, and it requires you to hover around the stove for the entire cooking time. Convinced that there was a faster, easier, cheaper, and more foolproof way to achieve the same results, I started poking around. Essentially, in order to create a low-temperature water cooker, all you need to do is keep a large body of water at the same temperature for a couple of hours. So, a well-insulated box should do the trick. And, fortunately, there's already a tool in pretty much every home that's designed precisely for the purpose of keeping large volumes of food or liquid at a stable temperature, the beer cooler. Here's how it works. A beer cooler can keep things cool because it is a two-walled plastic chamber with airspace between the walls. The airspace acts as an insulator, preventing thermal energy from the outside from reaching the cold food on the inside. Of course, insulators work both ways. The cooler is just as good at keeping thermal energy on the inside from escaping to the outside. Once you realize that a beer cooler is just as good at keeping hot things hot as it is at keeping cold things cold, the rest is easy. Fill your cooler with water just a couple degrees higher than the temperature you'd like to cook your food at, to account for temperature loss when you add the cold food. Seal your food in a Ziploc freezer bag, drop it in, and close your cooler. Leave the food there until it is cooked. It's as simple as that. But what about the vacuum? Surely vacuum sealing the food is an essential step in effective sous vide cooking. As it turns out, not really. The main reason to vacuum seal food is that any air bubbles trapped inside the plastic bag can act as an insulator, preventing the food from cooking evenly. As long as you can get all the bubbles out of your bag, there's no reason it shouldn't work just as well as a bag sealed with a vacuum sealer, and there's an easy way to do just that. This technique was demonstrated for me by Dave Arnold, an instructor at the French Culinary Institute and contributor to the Cooking Issues blog, www.cookingissues.com. 1. Place your food inside a Ziploc freezer bag and seal it, leaving the last inch unsealed. 2. Holding onto the bag, slowly lower it into a large pot, cooler, or sink full of water, using your hands to release any trapped air bubbles as you go. 3. Continue lowering it until just the very top edge of the bag is above the surface. Don't allow any water to leak inside. 4. Seal the bag. Now you have your food inside a completely airless bag. A note about nomenclature. While the term sous vide technically refers to the vacuum sealing portion of the cooking process, in common usage these days, it's come to mean the act of cooking food in a temperature-controlled water bath. So that's how I'm going to use it, even though my cooler method actually makes no use of a vacuum at all. Deal with it. So does the beer cooler method really work? I pitted my beer cooler freezer bag method, total cost $21.90, against a sous vide supreme food saver combo, total cost $569.98, comparing their performance in four categories. 1. The ability to cook proteins to a precise temperature all the way from the edges to the center. 2. The ability to hold cooked foods at serving temperature for several hours without any loss of quality. Low temperatures and a sealed bag prevent overcooking or loss of moisture from cooked foods. This is an invaluable asset, allowing a line cook or a harried spouse to serve hot food at a moment's notice without having to worry about precise timing. 3. The ability to tenderize tough pieces of meat. Traditional braises use relatively high temperatures, 180 degrees Fahrenheit or so, to tenderize tougher cuts. But at these temperatures, the muscle fibers will expel quite a bit of their juices. With sous vide cookery, much lower temperatures, say around 140